You said that, didn't you? You have the biographies.
Can someone go and get Michael? I'll start speaking, but so it's obviously complete nightmare trying to get a PowerPoint. I'm going to, since my presentation entirely depends on this PowerPoint and is as nugatory without it, I don't know. I'm going to start speaking. Like Harley, I feel physically sick when I think about translating and what translating involves. I'm going to speak today about simply translating a handful of poems by the late French medieval poet François Villon, who lived 1431 to about 1463. Actually, no one knows when he died. He disappears after being banished from Paris. You might know a little bit about him. I'll say a little more, but he was a genuine career criminal, like on the left bank of Paris, robbing universities, basically beating up monks, stabbing people, constantly in and out of both church and state prisons, because of course the church had their own torture chambers in those days, as they still do today, although not official ones, it seems. The other thing about Villon, he uses a very peculiar term, poids d'angoisse, which literally translates, I guess, as anguish pears or something like that, which hard pear from which you can get in, you can buy in France today. So I think from the Dordogne, I'm not 100% sure. Hard pear, but of course in the Middle Ages, you can use it as an image, a pear of anguish. You eat a pear of anguish, and the poems I will talk about, there's a lot of ingestion and poison, pretty comparable to the ways that Ali has just spoken about. Is this pleasure, is this pain, and how you have to incorporate things that make you sick, and they're not necessarily in a homeopathic way. But then thirdly, of course, an anguish pear is a metal ball that's inserted in the mouth, and the key is turned until your jaws are dislocated, which of course for a poet can prove a problem if you're then making money from reciting your verses at the court of show. All right, let's do this, and let's hope that this is going to work a little better. Is that all right? Fantastic. All right, I have about 30,000 words that I'd like to talk about with this single poem, which is a short ballad of Villon's from his great work, the Testament. However, I literally could write a book on this one tiny poem, and I'm planning on doing it. Unfortunately, I don't have the time today to talk to you for 30 hours continuously about this little poem. But I do just want to mention a few things about Villon in addition to the things I've already mentioned. First of all, the history dependent, the history of translations are affected by the history of translations as well. So when you're translating someone like Villon into English, it's a very different situation today, a very different situation from some of Ali's translations, for instance, where you're translating personages who have been almost completely unknown in an Anglophone world. On the contrary, with Villon, obviously he dies or disappears in the mid-15th century. There's a very famous authorised edition of his works in 1533 by the court poet Clément Leroux, a very, very important edition, and then he drops out of all circulation both in France and across Europe until the 19th century, where he's literally revivified in both in France and also in England, where he becomes incredibly popular again. And in England in particular, the history of Villon translation starts to be linked with Dante Gabriel Rossetti, Swinburne, Synge, Ezra Pound, Siegfried Sassoon, Basil Bunting, Robert Lowell, Tom Scott, Philip Levine, Galway Kinnell, Lewis Simpson, and on and on and on. To try and translate Villon today is already to enter into a history of all of already existing translations too, with which one is also, in a Harold Bloomian type way, competing. You have to be both different from all the others, and you have to steal from all the others the translations as well as the original too. But then when, of course, you go back to the original, because there's only four manuscripts from the 15th century itself of Villon's poems, Moreau, when he's sent out by François I to do, the authorised edition of Villon, he's listening to old men singing these poems which have been memorised on the from early youth, and therefore a whole series of variants emerge. So there's no original, there's only variants in the origin. And because orthography is of course not established in the 15th century, all sorts of like crazy spellings and variants from the very first, which of course already then complicates what it is that you're doing when you're translating. waiting. And so there's so much to speak about with this situation and this situation of translating the one. Can someone get Michael? Sorry,
he's coming.
That's okay. I just feel without this, I'm dying out here. Right. What I want to concentrate on today is something like I think it's quite strange. It's not spoken enough, in my opinion, in translating, which is a problem which seems to be not a problem at all for the most part, and that's the problem of the translation of proper names. Because a proper name, one would think, remains invariant under all conditions within a kind of a language situation. You think a proper name is, for example, the commonsensical, I guess, analytical philosophical view is a proper name is a rigid designator. It doesn't change. It doesn't change across languages. It's given by a kind of primal baptism or a sacrament. I hereby name you, Justin Clemens Francois Villon, or Chris Wallace Krabs, Simon West, Brian Nelson, whoever named you, you have the sense that this name remains, or should remain, invariant across languages. Now, I want to point out that not only is this not the case, but when you're trying to, in some poets, and poets like Villon in particular, he actually takes the destruction of the proper name and the vicissitudes of pronunciation and inscription of this name as part of his poetics itself, such that when he invokes proper names, those proper names are not simply invoked as people who we really know, but people who we really don't know and don't really know themselves and never really had a name in the first place, and these names are specifically chosen in their context to designate this, and if we just reproduce those names today, then no one will have a clue. You'll think they're just proper names like any other names, and you'll miss exactly what it is about Villon, what Villon is doing with these proper names in particular, which are not proper names, or they're proper names on the verge of already disappearing, or they signify a disappearance. I hope that makes sense. So what is meant to be invariant throughout different languages, which should be able to be translated, not even translated, simply transliterated, like even that can't be done in the case of someone like Villon. And I'm going to speak about that now, specifically with respect to maybe the most famous Villon poem of all. It's set in his great testament. I'm going to say a bit more about this. Sorry, Lane, do you mind hand me that weird device?
If we keep moving this every 4 minutes,
I'm going to move it. I'm going to twitch continuously to make sure it never drops out. Now, this I originally was going to call this a testimony of my experience of translating Villon, and of course the word testimony is also crucial here because his greatest work is the Testament of 14, usually assigned to 1461. It's a false will. So it's a fake will. It's in the form of a will, a last will and testament, but of course it's a false will. It's set in contemporaneous urban Paris and France, barely emerging from the aftermath of the Hundred Years' War with the English. It's full of incredible topographical, institutional, and personal details. It ranges widely, not only in its forms of address, but in its topics and tone, from high to low, back again. Its language constantly shifts from the familiar and to the highfalutin, and from criminal argot. He was associated with a gang of criminals called the Coquillard, who had their own thieves' cant or slang, designed so no one could understand it. Now, if you think when you're translating that no one knows what this, by definition, this is a language that is designed for no one to understand outside what it means, and nonetheless, Villon has put it in there and inscribed it within his own poetry to go, who do you think you are? You're not going to get this. And I'm going to name and use words such that no translation will ever be possible except a speculative one. Or he's already in advance, destroying the very possibility of any authorized translation. And what is he doing it in? Something that's his last will and testament, something that has to be attested to, and which he swears, and I say this quite specifically, he swears on his own testicle that this is the case. Now, you must know that one of the hallmarks of, I'm not sure if it's, I think it's apocryphal, but in Roman law, obviously only men can be testators because only men have testicles. The etymology of this term is the same. I'm going to come back to this. I'm not just saying this for a joke. Villon is very dirty, but he makes very, very serious jokes as well. And of course, you swear on your balls. Yes, I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So you clutch your testicles. So there's a physical reference which one needs. The problem is, in one of the towards the end of the Testament, there's a great moment where there's an intercalated testimony in the form of a ballad from someone who isn't Villon, obviously written by Villon, but actually about Villon and how Villon left the world. And so it comes at the end of the Testament, written exactly the same style as Villon's poetry normally, but about Villon by someone who's normally not Villon, talking about how Villon left this world and how he died and therefore opened up the possibility for the Testament. And one of the things that, one of the hilarious things that spoken of is, I'm going to use a Barbara Sajon-Bohr translation for this. Here closes and comes to an end the testament of poor Villon. Come to attend his burial when you will hear the carillon. Dressed in red like vermilion, a martyr did he die in love. He swore it on his testicle when just about to leave this world. Now, the problem with this is obviously he's alluding to the idea to be a true test, you're swearing on your own body and an important part of your own body and a masculine part of the body. However, Villon, despite being a criminal and despite being in and out of all sorts of hijinks, the first thing he's in prison for is for stabbing Philippe Sermoise in the groin with a rusty penknife. Like Philippe apparently comes up while Villon's sitting there on a bench, young guy, talking to a woman. All of a sudden, Philippe and his friend walk up, there's an altercation, and Villon pulls a knife out of his pocket and stabs Philippe directly in the groin. There's a bit of an argy-bargy. Philippe dies a few days later. But the first criminal act that is attested to in Villon's history is him stabbing another priest in the balls, basically. The other thing is that he was a Master of Arts from the University of Paris. He wasn't just a street criminal, he was a street criminal, a very nasty one too, and one you would not want to bump into, despite all the romantics who of course, all the post-romantics like Rossetti and so on, who loved him as a kind of, you know, a slightly dissolute, threatening, but nonetheless essentially romantic character. Not a nice guy, but a genuine Master of Arts from the University of Paris. He in fact grew up with his adoptive uncle, I suppose, on the left bank of Paris, and his uncle, in fact, Villon's real name, we're not sure, it could be Montcalbier, it could be Deloge, it could be, in fact, he gives some fake names, but Villon is an adoptive name, not his own name, and his uncle, Villon, whose name he takes, is in fact a professor of canon law on the left bank of Paris. And of course, growing up in an environment of where you don't even have the real name of your father, i.e. the sexual transmission and the linguistic transmission has not come down, the seed of the semen and the seed of the name has not been transmitted properly to Villon, which is, of course, literally playing on these crazy disseminations, to use a term of Jacques Derrida's. But also, he knows very well that there's a Latin a problem in Roman law, which is unus testis, testis nullus, i.e. if you have only one witness, it counts as no witness at all, because, of course, you need at least two independent witnesses to confirm an event. So when, in the very final verse, which I just quoted for you before, of this ballade, Villon is said to have sworn on his testicle, not on his testicles, plural, it's a joke. You can't trust this at all. One witness, one testicle, is no witness at all. And there's also another problem, which is, nobody can act as a witness in law on their own behalf. Testis in rea propria sua. Like, can't do that, right? So there's a joke about transmission, names, body parts, testicles, and the constant shifting away and destruction of these names and destruction of body parts both which build in Fillon's own experiences that we know about from the legal documents, but also that he plays on in the quasi-legal document or the fake legal document that is his last will and testament. So it's full of these sorts of jokes. And of course, if you know anything about Aristotle, you'll know that, is it a male ball or a female ball? Because if the sperm comes from your left testicle, you're going to have girl babies. And if it comes from your dexter, not your sinister testicle, which is of course the left one, you're going to have male babies. So there's in fact a kind of crazy practice among Aristotelian inflected people tying up their testicles to make sure they get the right child from their own. So you can see where I'm going with this. I hope you can see where I'm going with this. Now, to look at this, ballad, and I'm just going to go. It's like a totally, like one of the master, as like all of the commentators, D.B. Wyndham Lewis in the early 20th century, as he points out, this is one of the master lyrics of Western poetry. There's absolutely, it is unbelievable. It is unbelievable. And I'm going to now, very quickly, I just want to draw your attention to these names, because I'm talking about the proper names. Flora, Archibiades, Thais, Echo, Eloise, who is, of course, Pierre Espaillat, or Abelardus, because, of course, these people are... Abelard will come back to, you know, well, I can see people grinning already, because if you know anything about Abelard and Eloise, you'll know that the testicle joke is not just a joke for the poor bastard. Buridan, Blanche, Beatrice, Alice, Arabourguet, Jean, Joan of Arc, the good Lorraine. I have to tell you, I met Ali Elizadeh when he was doing his PhD, an epic poem on Joan of Arc. Totally insane. The Virgin Mary, and then, like in the Envoi, just an unnamed prince. Prince. Now, here's one of the greatest translations into English of this poem. The refrain, même sans les méchants in French, but in English, what Rossetti does is this incredible refrain, now very, very famous. Even Ezra Pound, who struggled with this, couldn't do better, but where are the snows of yesteryear? Very, very famous line. It crops up everywhere, including in Catch 22, where it becomes, where are the Snowdens of yesteryear? A kind of like nominal joke as well. But you can see already, Archipiada has somehow become Hipparchia in the translation. Thais retains the echo too. But Abelard takes on a strange spelling, like acceptable, but one of the many variants of Abelard that you can have in English. And then, of course, Jean of Buridan, Bertha Broadfoot, Beatrice, Alice, and Ermengarde, not Arundel-Yi, and that good Joan, and Mother of God. Fair Lord, Prince has become Fair Lord, and you can begin to see there's an incredible, already in the very earliest translations into English, even the proper names start to become radically unstable, and part of the reason is because no one could, because as I have said, the most important thing, one of the most important things about this poem in French is that these names are chosen for the instability of their signification and their reference. And of course, the poem itself, as you can see, is all about, it's of the, what's called in Latin, the ubi sunt genre. Where are they now? Timor mortis conter, the fear of death confounds me. They have all gone. Where are the snows of yesteryear? This is the refrain that keeps returning. It's a poem about death and about the inexorable disappearance of absolutely all of us. And so one of the things to point to with the names is that these names are chosen because they're sort of famous, but no one really knows anything about who they are. And to the extent that they do, and I'm going to go into a bit more detail in a minute if I have some time, is that you realise what they're famous for is losing parts of themselves in a really terrible way while they're alive, and therefore becoming emblematic of a kind of the castration before the castration unto death. So that's Rossetti. It's quite beautiful, but you can also see his faux archaisms, which he introduces into the English translation in order to alert you within the translation itself and without supplementary scholarly footnotes and so on, that in fact this is a poem from another place and another time, which is a kind of a great tactic. Not everyone sticks to it, because some people, when they translate Villon into English, want to totally contemporaneize young eyes, the signification as if you were in Philon's time speaking street slang, like the guy speaking street slang to you. Terrible choice, and of course another total problem for translators. You're going to have to make a choice, and one way or another you're going to fail like miserably, like in a sickening way. Here's John Payne. Archipiade has returned to almost Archipiade, but not quite. Thais and Flora Echo. We've still got Eloisa is now Eloise has now become Eloise. This is our third version so far. Eloise, our third version, and so on. And you can see that the desperation, Beatrix, Ehrenberg, Alice. By the time he gets to the third stanza, Payne has no idea what to do with all these different names, so he shoves them all in the line towards the end of the stanza and tries to forget about them and gives them all variant spellings. Of course, in the French itself, part of the way in which the dissemination of the names takes place is in the repetition of sounds, which is shared by these names, but don't just follow the rhyme scheme, the formal patterning of the ballade, but start to disseminate within the poem itself. And so, as it's recited, you hear the ee, 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 and it's associated with all these, and it's a sound of fading, just like echo, when echo's fading voice echoes back, echo's voice echoes back, it's always fading. Echo, of course, not an irrelevant name in this context, but I hope you get what I'm saying. Andrew Lang, the great scholar, like, nay, but where is the last year's snow? But you can see also, he's having some problems with Archipiade. We've got two P's for the poor woman, who actually, maybe I should say now, Archipiade is not a woman, but the medievals thought he was. And it's a terrible mistake, because they really didn't like ancient Greek male-male sodomy. And it turns out that Archipiade is a Boethian mistake for Alcibiades, the great warlord of ancient Athens and paramour, and some more false paramour, of Socrates, with Socrates, Alcibiades, his most famous, most handsome man in ancient Athens, tries to fuck Socrates, the ugliest man in ancient Athens. Socrates says, no thanks, mate, I only go for spiritual beauty and platonic love. But of course, Archipiade is how Alcibiades survives into the medieval world, where of course male-male love of that kind is so totally unacceptable. In fact, he'd be burnt alive at the stake for it. Joan of Arc is also mentioned there being burned alive at the stake. Now, what a beautiful poem, but when you start to ask about the significance of these proper names, it's all about torture and death as well. I would point out the water metaphors, echo over by mere or stream. For some reason, English translators keep wanting to translate pond, etang, by mere, because it has mere. So it must sound nice to them. But Flora, I'm now going to do this, even though...
Yep.
Oh my God, I'm performing the poem, The Disappearance of this. Now, Flora, of course, is a goddess, a Roman goddess of flowers, but she's also a prostitute who made so much money that this is at least the mythical origin of the Floralia festival in Rome, and then taken up again by some crazy Italians in the Renaissance. But Flora, goddess of flowers, was originally a prostitute who made so much money. In order to clear her name, she gave so much money to the city of Rome that they put up they started an annual festival in her honour, in which she was celebrated for being, in fact, the goddess of flowers and not the goddess of prostitution. But we already have a problem. I've mentioned Archipiade, or Alcibiades, or Hipparchia, if you want to do the recessive thing, which is another name altogether about something. Anyway. Thais, of course, also a famous courtesan. Echo, a nymph. Right, and a mythological character who's famous for her disappearance. In fact, her name is precisely the response of her own disappearance. Can you see what I mean? This incredible thing all the way through. Now, Eloise and Abelard, very, very famous, but I don't think I might actually read out some of the things about Abelard here, because, as I said before, both, well, Buridan also, Jean Buridan is also in the same stanza. The title that it's normally given to this poem is actually Interpolation by Moreau from 1533. It has no title when it appears in the body of the testament itself. And of course, Moreau named it basically Ballad of Dead Ladies. But this middle stanza, well, first of all, like a piada isn't, is it? But, to look at. But Abelard and Buridan are not ladies, they're very, very, very famous philosophers. In fact, they're maybe two of the greatest philosophers, medieval philosophers, that ever lived. And Abelard, although he's famous for having his balls cut off by Canon Fulbert, who is, of course, Eloise's uncle, and so we can see the uncle thing happening, as I said, the adoptive uncle of Villon was Villon. But anyway, we'll come back. But the castration jokes are not just castration jokes. They're locked into the poem. And Buridan, this story around Buridan, who is of course now most famous for something he apparently never said, Buridan's ass, which is a sophistic problem. Look, let me just actually read this instead of having me ramble about. I said sophistic, but they're all sadistic too. This is a very, very, very beautiful poem, but it's also, as I've already been pointing to, it's a torture poem. Like sex and death are already inscribed in all of those names, but in ways that in the names themselves, the reference and the signification becomes obscure, and that self-reference almost, the names to their own disappearance, takes place across the poem in a number of ways. How does one convey that as a translator? It seems to me it is totally, unutterably impossible. And nonetheless, every translator, and obviously I don't have time to speak to you for 30 hours, I would want to point to the very different decisions, but the real decisions that some of these translators have made, clearly recognising this issue, but also trying to convey something of the poem as poem without scholarly apparatus or dissatisfactory secondary elaborations to try and earnestly explain to you all of the things that are going on in the poem, which of course I'm earnestly explaining to you now. I should also say that even all of the great interpretations of this poem, some very, very famous, European, master scholars, Leo Spitzer, many, many others, have said about this poem, which is very interesting, even though they never really go into it, is the rest of the Testament is marked by scholarly epistemophilia. Scholars just go, this name meant this, this name meant this, this name. When it comes to this poem, people stop actually asking about the names. I think I'm one of the few people to start really talking about the names in this way, although there are others. But let me just read out some stuff and then try and shut up. Okay, Abelard and Buridan. They're not only famous Parisian intellectuals, Buridan was in fact rector of Paris at the University of Paris at one stage, and Abelard, absolutely notorious, not least for obviously the epistle for his castration and the epistolary correspondence. But both of them are famous not just for their institutional power and their intellectual centrality, but also because they have this integral relationship to women in a quasi-mythical way. Now, Abelard was obviously Eloise's tutor. They had a child named Astrolabe out of wedlock. As I said before, Eloise's uncle, Canon Fulbert, has Abelard castrated. Thereafter, Abelard's off to Saint-Denis, which is a Benedictine monastery at the time. So Abelard is, in other words, he's a man who's very unchaste and then enforcedly chaste and chastened. And the language of Villon's poem directly nominates this. The phrase, où est la très sage Eloise, très sage, very wise technically, but it's linked to sagesse, a word which naturally appears in the writings of Abelard and Eloise themselves. And in fact, this also, in fact, in Latin it's sapientissimus, and that word turns up at the end of the history of my calamity, is literally in the Latin. And so there's already these translations, like this poem of Villon's, he's already playing on multiple languages in the very epithets that he's assigning. Tressage is a, you know, you can get away with just saying very wise, not, it doesn't seem very complex, but actually then when you start to pull the relations to Abelard and Eloise themselves, you realise it appears in their writings, and that it also has a Latin, but it also has another reference too, which links it to all of these women in the third stanza, some of whom are from Chanson de Geste, one of whom is allegedly Bertha Broadfoot, allegedly Charlemagne's mother, and so on. But of course, once again, like Flora, it turns out they all have at least a double significance. I have to say that Blanche of Navarre, who might be La Reine Blanche, the White Queen or the Queen Blanche, Blanche of Navarre, her nickname was Belle Sagesse. And so even in the epithets of preceding stanzas are both echoing and anticipating personages who are named in the stanzas to come. So how do you get that into a translation where you have to find the right epithet that's going to work in English, that's going to both nominate these people and be quite straightforward, and you can in fact miss it because it's such a common phrase, but also simultaneously have about three or four levels of allusion, not just outside the poem and to existing legends and also to other languages, Latin and French, but also to within the poem itself, it's set up this incredible internal interferences, which are not just significatory and euphonious, but also do something in that euphony. So the black humour that's prevalent throughout the Testament, but so often held to be missing in these, this is one of the worst English translations ever, if you don't mind me saying. Absolutely awful. Near. You'd see Hipparchia's back, you know, with even variant spelling once again. Archibiade in Leper's version. This is a great, great version into by Tom Scott. Tell me what, where couldn't she place flower? Where are the snores one sign? How great is that? All right. But there's another level of these names that's really, really terrible. Sorry, please stop me if I'm going on. I've totally lost track of time. In addition to his amorous adventures, Abelard is, as I said before, he's one of the greatest figures in the history of logic. And he's one of the first of the so-called nominalist philosophers. If we had some time, we would talk about the problems in what's called relevant logic today with the material conditional and how it's an anti-Aristotelian form of logic, which of course is the Aristotelian logic that's being taught to these medieval guys, but Abelard, in addition to losing his testicles, also seems to have added something to the thought of the material conditional and logical implications. But as a nominalist himself, he also writes about proper names, and I would presume, even though I have not been able to find direct evidence that Villon himself would have to have known this passage of Abelard's or these aspects of Abelard's work. I'm going to give you some now, which are about the signification of proper names in Abelard's work. Okay? Right. As an nominalist, Abelard denies the real existence of universals. These are nothing but words, or in fact a kind of almost phantasm of thinking, and proposes that the impositor of names, I quote Abelard, meant to impose them in accordance with certain natures or characteristics of things, even if he did not know how to think out the nature or characteristic of the thing. End of quote. Now, whatever the difficulties with this position, it's clear that in Abelard, a proper name is linked integrally, whether knowingly or not, to a feature of the thing that it names. But what happens, and this is immediately a problem in Abelard's own metaphysics, what happens to the sense or reference of a name when a part of the thing itself disappears, or when the thing itself disappears? Right, now you can see that it's back to the thematic of where are the snows of yesteryear. And the problem of time and change return at the heart of the name itself. In Peter King's exegesis, quote, Abelard is a presentist. Only the present exists, although past times did exist, they just exist no longer, and that future times will exist, but they do not yet exist. Abelard is not rejecting the reality of time so much as calling attention to the fact that existence is tied to the present instance alone, which of course returns us to Villon's use of this in his poem. For Villon, there's no point, if you believe Abelard, in asking where exactly last year's snows are gone. They're simply non-existent. It's illogical. Now, this is a philosophical, metaphysical position that actually returns in the refrain, which looks so beautiful and poetic and elegiac, but in fact is a comment on Abelard. But it's also a joke at Abelard's expense, because to believe that, you'd have to believe an unfortunate castrate whose philosophical positions could not prevent him from being led astray, mutilated, and then enclosed in a darkness which remained unleavened by further philosophizing. And into the bargain, you would have to then believe someone who no longer exists, who survives only in name alone. And if you believe the guy whose name survives only in name alone, then that name no longer refers to anything, and so there's no substance to the very name that's being invoked according to the substance of the name that is being invoked, right? Now, there seems to be no question, if you look at the rest of the Testament, Villon is this kind of thinker. These jokes are polylingual, incredibly erudite, and incredibly... They're actually commentaries on metaphysics, as well as their beautiful poems about... Yeah, well, this is a beautiful poem. Now, to come back to Buridan, and I'll finish with Buridan. Twice rector of the University of Paris, of course, Villon's own alma mater. This is a triple joke here. First, Buridan was renowned for being a ladies' man who, in the course of his adventures, had an encounter with Queen Jeanne, who, of course, then shares her name. Queen Jeanne, powerful sovereign, but also a slut in the legend. I use that word advisedly. Of course, links it to Joan, the chaste maiden who's burnt by the British. And so even the names return, signifying complete antitheses across them, within them, in all of the references. Does this make sense? Okay. He had an encounter with Queen Jeanne, who, as was allegedly her wont, would have her lovers bagged and thrown into the Seine from a window of the tower. Because Buridan is so intelligent, knowing Jeanne's proclivities, he has a barge full of straw sail past just as he's being defenestrated, thereby landing in the straw in the sack and saved from drowning in the Seine. And the story is, needless to say, apocryphal, and is possibly known to be apocryphal by Villon himself. Villon's, playing on the apocrypha and the false ideas you might have about these names. That's the first aspect. The second thing, one of Buridan's famous sophismata, Sophism 17, is entitled "You Will Throw Me in the Water." If you had a medieval scholastic education, you would have to sit through 30-hour lectures on, these sorts of logical paradoxes. And this is in Buridan himself. It's one of Buridan's sort of paradoxes. Plato, guarding a bridge, tells Socrates that the latter can cross if the first proposition he utters is true. If not, Plato will throw Socrates in the water. And Socrates at once responds, "You will throw me in the water." Now, if that's true, it's false. If it's false, it's true. Socrates has just stymied Plato. Now, you can see why, this joke, once again, is linked to a metaphysics, but also it's linked to think all the way through this water metaphors, echo in water. I have to tell you that most of the torture that we know that Villon underwent was water torture. Okay, I've nearly finished. And so...
No, closer to the mic.
Oh, close to the mic, sorry.
God.
Oh, God. So Villon's own personal, most of his tortures were actually water tortures. They weren't anguish pairs. But it was a medieval equivalent of waterboarding, essentially. Like large amounts of water were forced into the victim's mouth. And the sense of death and dying. So, of course, that's in the background too. But not only the water metaphors, there's also Abelard's. There's literally the elements in this. If you look at the poem very carefully, you start to see water, air, fire, and in fact, I guess metals too, kind of the metals of which, of course, come from under Earth. So earth, wind, air, and fire. It's like a, so also through this is a whole series sequence of elements, which these proper names are also tied to certain elemental forces as well. Finally, so that's the first thing. Throw Buridan in the water, Buridan's joke, or like intellectual paradox about you will throw him in the water. And then thirdly, this is Buridan is influential in scholasticism for his modification of Aristotle's theory of movement. One of the great historians of science of the 20th century, a guy called Alexander Quare, has pointed out Aristotle's theory of movement has only one flaw beside that of being false. That have been contradicted by everyday practice. Like, obviously, you know. And what is that practice? It's the practice of throwing. For in Aristotelian physics, everything is in an ordered cosmos in which everything has a place and desires to return to that place. All motion should be is natural. What natural motion is, you knock something off and it falls to the floor, it wants to return down. Like, certain other substances want to move upwards. But there's an idea in a violent or counter-natural movement in Aristotle's physics, which is something that throwing something up against its nature. There's already some violence, like that one can fall, but I threw it up. It will come back to its place. The problem is for Aristotle, for something to keep moving, a constant force has to continue to be exerted on it so it keeps moving. But of course, if you throw, no, there was only force at the beginning and then there was no further force. How come it keeps, how does this projectile keep moving? Now, Buridan, who's thrown out of the window, who has jokes about being thrown, who has logical paradoxes about throwing people in water or not in the water, also modifies Aristotle's theory by suggesting that in moving, the movement itself produces more movement as a cause. And so it's called impetus physics. As something moves against Aristotle, the very force of moving produces more movement, but of a lesser kind. And this is itself Buridan's famous modification of the Aristotelian physics. So you can see, there's log. Oh, where is last year's snow? There it is again. But where are the snows of last winter? Where are the snows of yesteryear? What a genius! How can you? You can't better that. Yeah. So Robert Shirley just gives in. Good for him. Lewis, where are the snows of yesterday? You're just cheating, aren't you? That's totally hopeless. Martin Sorrell, he's actually done some very beautiful poems. I recommend this guy. He's done some very, very great variant translations of Villon. Where's worldly wide Eloise, who caused Abelard to be gelded, then tonsured in Saint-Denis. And he gets something about internal, messing with the internal rhyme. So things start to move and the recurrences of sound in places where they shouldn't be. Anyway, I think he's good. And then here's my miserable attempt. I'll probably finish just by talking about, so slung in a sack into the shoals, where are the snows of vanished years? This is a joke at Buridan's projectile physics. What it seems to me that Villon does, and you can see it throughout the Testament, and obviously I don't have time, but hopefully what I've said already is it gives enough of an indication of this, is that what Villon thinks that Buridan's modified physics is about, it's not about the physical world, but about the name, throwing the name forward in time, where it just starts to vanish and disappear and become emptier and emptier. The Buridanian physics is not a physics at all, it's a philological issue. The name that's flung forward gets emptier and emptier, it has lost its reference, and then it will die like any other name. And it will be, you won't save yourself by having a barge sail past, basically. So if I can finish, I just might read out my own translation. There's some terrible things about it, and there's some okay things about it, but here we go. You tell me where, give me a name, it's flora in our room's loveliness. And have the two succumb the same, Archibiada and Thais, or Echo. Oh, her beauty bless, who answers back with fading tears when sound rings out on rock or ness. Where are the snows of vanished years? Was Eloise so wise for whom poor Abelard mislaid his balls and found a duck in Sarah's room? The heights of love give way to falls. And similarly, that queen whose call saw Buridan caught by his ears, slung in a sack into the shoals. Where are the snows of vanished years? The lily blanched, that queen's voice was sweet as any siren strain. Big-footed Berta, Alice, Beatrice, or Erenburg, who held the mane. And Joan, the virtuous Lorraine, the English bird for Rouen spears. Where are they, virgin, and their pain? Where are the snows of vanished years? Prince, ask not this week where they have gone, nor ask though Christmas nears, or else you'll hear this line replay. Where are the snows of vanished years?
Follow that, please.